is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Christopher Tin, and I can't tell you, first of all, what a fan I am, and also how much I'm looking forward to talking with you about your album, To Shiver the Sky.
Thank you for having me, Kate. I mean, I'm thrilled to finally be able to chat with you on air about all of this stuff. So, yeah, good that we finally connected.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been a Kickstarter backer of this project. As soon as it came on my radar, I was like, oh, this is just going to be phenomenal, and it's just beyond anything I expected. And congratulations, first of all, on having such an overwhelmingly successful Kickstarter campaign.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, you know, and thank you for contributing to that success. It was quite startling for me, I got to say, when it turned out the way it did. But I'm very pleased.
Well, yeah. And we are the beneficiaries, because I'm sure you had a budget in mind for this massive project, but it was able to grow and grow and grow. And as you were watching the funds come in, what was that like? I mean, were you like doing mental calculations for, oh, well, now I can use the Royal Philharmonic, or now I can use the Royal Opera Chorus?
You know, truth be told, this album is just about as expensive as the previous two albums. I mean, it's, you know, these are huge budget productions, right? And the Kickstarter basically kind of covered it, barely. It's one of those situations, right? So much of my life is about passion projects. I'm very much about that. And for me, I was never actually going to compromise on the quality of To Shiver the Sky. If the Kickstarter had only, you know, barely met my initial aim and just gotten me a little bit of money, I still would have made it at this scale and this production level, just because, you know, when you, like, if you're passionate about something, you want to make it as good as possible, right? And these albums of mine, they're, you know, my little creative corner where I get to say, hey, I'm the boss. I want this to have these singers and these players on it. I want it to sound this good. You know, I want to spend 2 years writing this as opposed to 2 weeks writing this. I mean, it's really, you know, where you get to express yourself as an artist. And I take that very seriously. And so I'm not about to shoot myself in the foot by compromising on quality on things like this. So however the Kickstarter turned out, you know, ultimately the album probably would have been the same. But I tell you, what this does for me is that it means that I can rebound right away and start working on the next album right away. That's the beauty of the Kickstarter. Like, I don't have to wait for the funds to be recouped through album sales and things like that. I'm ready to go, and I'm already starting to put together ideas for the next thing.
Ooh, that's very exciting. The concept of To Shiver the Sky is just an epic journey. It's humanity's ambitions to reach the heavens and beyond. And from what you've said, it grew out of Sogno di Volare, Leonardo's writings about just thinking about what a flight would be like. And it was used in the trailer for Civilization VI. But so you've been kicking it around for a while, but I'm kind of wondering what the moment was for you when you decided to just, you know, jump off the diving board and get this project going.
You know, for me, what it was I, like, a lot of times what happens when I finish a project, like in 2014, I finished my second album called The Drop That Contained the Sea, and I was very pleased with how it turned out. But then immediately I was left with what's next, right? And it wasn't until 2016 that I wrote Sogno di Volare for Civilization VI, where I thought, well, here's some promising material as the next springboard for the next project, perhaps. But at that point, I had other pretty good tracks that I was feeling good about that I also wanted to use as springboards for a flight-themed album of some sort. And I just wasn't able to get them all to sit together on one disc in a sensible sort of way. You know, my big thing is I like concept albums, you know, albums that aren't just a collection of random tracks, but actually have a narrative or a through line or some sort of connective tissue amongst all the music, right? And I spent 2 years basically trying to say, okay, well, how can I make song A coexist with song B on, you know, this next album? Just trying to work all of that out. And finally, I realized, you know what? I just can't. Let's split them into two separate albums. So I decided to base this one off of Sogno di Volare. And, you know, when I took a look at what Sogno di Volare was, which was this song about Leonardo's dreams about a flying machine, I thought, you know what? This is the perfect track one for an album about the history of mankind's quest to fly. And that was the big turning point. And once I had that in motion, that's when I said, okay, let's put together a Kickstarter, see what happens. And then I put together the Kickstarter, as you know. And then at that point, I actually turned to my backers and I said, okay, here's the rough idea. You know, throw some ideas at me. Let's talk about this, you know. And I sort of crowdsourced the storytelling aspect of this album. Like, you know, who are the big people who play a major role in the history of flight? You know, what are some of the issues involved? And what I quickly found out was a lot of my backers actually worked in either aviation or aerospace. And they came forward with stories like, you know, I went and I got a PhD in astronautics because I wanted to create satellites or whatever. You know, I wanted to work on satellites and help launch them into space. But in the back of my mind, I know that at some point, the technologies that I helped develop will probably also be used by the military for military purposes. And that's just kind of this friction, you know, this dissonance that a lot of people who work in aerospace just kind of have to grapple with, right? I mean, you know, the best example of that is, of course, Robert Oppenheimer, right?
Right, yeah.
who makes an appearance on the album. Mm-hmm. But another example is, Ferdinand von Zeppelin, who also makes an appearance on the album. There's a track called "Oh, the Humanity," which basically tells the story of the age of airships, right? And it begins by Ferdinand von Zeppelin giving a very optimistic speech, saying he's hopeful that his new invention, the Zeppelin, will be used by the government for peaceful interaction between nations and the advancement of science and technology. And instead, in 1915, it's used for dropping bombs on London, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And then, flash forward 20 years later or so with the Hindenburg disaster, and that sort of signals the end of, the airship era, right? But this is kind of a story that gets repeated over and over again across the scope of history, right? Scientific developments are often... they are often either, spurred forward by military necessity or, are kind of created hand in hand with the military. That's just the nature of history, right? But what I also found very, reassuring in all of the speeches and all the research I did is that there's often, by our policymakers and those people who have actually been to outer space, there is often a message of, let's not destroy the world. Let's use our technology for peaceful means. Like John F. Kennedy's moon landing speech, which makes the climactic finale of To Share the Sky, he was basically espousing space not being the next frontier as a theater of war, but as a frontier for science and learning and education. I mean, it's a very sort of Star Trekian vision of the future and of space. And that really appealed to me as well.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you've got a text from Yuri Gagarin, too, who was, if I got my facts right, he was the first man in space. And he also is urging us to not destroy the planet, but to preserve it and wonder at it, I guess, and what we've been able to do as well.
Yes. I mean, that was so striking to me because this was at the height of the Cold War, when we're at the 11th hour on the nuclear clock and our sort of mutual destruction is sort of imminent. The one person who's able to leave the planet and look back on the Earth comes back and says, people, orbiting Earth in my spaceship, I saw how beautiful it is. Let us enhance and preserve this beauty and not destroy it. And, that was a very powerful message of peace, I thought.
how in the world, I mean, you mentioned that you crowdsourced ideas for the texts, but that's a lot still to sift through. And the texts that you've chosen, by Hildegard of Bingen and Ovid and Dante and Copernicus, how did you eventually settle on those texts?
A lot of times it just comes down to what is in those texts. Like, there are gaping holes of sort of like flight personalities that are missing from my album. For example, the Wright brothers. You know, you would think that they're kind of a big deal, right, in the history of flight. Frankly, they honestly didn't say anything that made good lyrics. That's kind of what it came down to, right? You know, Charles Lindbergh, I thought, okay, well, you know, there's a pioneer as well. But, you know, I also felt it was very important to do Amelia Earhart, because she's not only a pioneer for aviation history, but also a pioneer for, women's rights, obviously, but, a social pioneer, right? And that's kind of a recurring motive here. It's not just about who checked off this flight record or who did this first, right? It's also about what the history of flight has meant to humanity and the sciences and the arts and the progress of civilization. That is what's important to me about the story of flight. It's about all, you know, the greatness that comes out of our achievement of this one goal and all the wonderful side benefits that come out of it.
Well, it must have been really helpful to decide to plan out the album to have the texts be chronological, starting after the gorgeous setting of Leonardo's Sogno di Volare with the text by Hildegard of Bingen, The Heavenly Kingdom. And I know, reading back through some of your Kickstarter updates, you also had an idea of creating, along with that, the sort of history of Western music over hundreds of years. I mean, I can hear little glimpses of Hildegard's own music in your setting of The Heavenly Kingdom. But besides that, how did that work out?
Okay. All right. So yes. I mean, you know, I think one of the hallmarks of what, you know, my little passion projects is I cram them with so many layers of meaning, you know, and so many sort of architectural structures that connect everything together. And one of them, as you know, from being a backer, is very early on, I said, you know what? While we're telling the history of flight, let's also tell it through the history of orchestration, essentially, right? That was the initial goal. What I quickly found out is that, yes, while it's fun to say in abstract, hey, I'm going to make this movement sound very Baroque, and this movement sound very classical, and this movement sound very romantic, and so forth, you know, when it comes down to the nuts and bolts of it, to find a musical language for a text as old as the Daedalus and Icarus myth, right? To couch it either in you know, ancient music or even Renaissance music. And I mentioned the Renaissance because that's when, you know, Greek mythology and Ovid had a Renaissance in painting and art and literature, right? That's when painters were, you know, obsessed with Greek mythology and things like that, and Shakespeare, and, you know, across the disciplines, right? This sort of like rediscovery of the classics. If I wanted to stay true to my little creative program, I would have had to write something that sounded vaguely Renaissance-y. And I will say this right now, I am not a fan of Renaissance music, like you know, true historical early music, Renaissance music, just it doesn't do it for me. So it became a question of, okay, kind of evoking sort of a sound era, a sound world that sort of sounds like the story that's being told here, oftentimes balancing that with the idea of, you know, like really making something sound like it was written in that era. So to give you an example, Movement 6, To the Stars, it's a setting of Jules Verne, and it's the one French movement on the album. And it's important because Jules Verne is a science, is basically the creator of the genre of science fiction, right? Science fiction is very important to the history of flight because science fiction is what captured the imagination of the public and made the public eager for things like space exploration. And if the public hadn't been prepped for this idea of space exploration, when John F. Kennedy gave his speech, you know, in 1962, I think it was, the public wouldn't have gone on board with this, right? He needed buy-in from everyone to say, hey, we're going to put a man on the moon and return him safely. Without having that political capital from, you know, the public being primed and excited for space flight, he probably could not have had this, seen his vision all the way through, right? So, you know, movements like that, the French movement, it sounds very French. Honestly, I spent a lot of time pouring through Ravel and Debussy, you know, just...
I thought just so.
Yeah, I totally did. I totally did. And there's touches of Gershwin in there. There's touches of, you know, other stuff. It's never just one thing, is it? But, I mean, there were, you know, legitimate attempts to make, you know, the German Zeppelin movement, Oh the Humanity, sound kind of Mahlerian, you know, or the French movement to sound kind of Debussy-ish, or the Courage movement with text by Amelia Earhart to sound vaguely, you know, Samuel Barber or something like that, or the JFK movement to sound Copeland-y, you know, to try to capture sort of the post-war optimism of America. Like, you know, there was a deliberate attempt in most of these cases to achieve that. And in some cases, you just have to make compromises because Renaissance music is boring to me personally. So just can't stay totally strict to your program. The music has to come first.
Of course.
The music always has to come first. Your little fanciful ideas of, you know, Easter eggs and all these other sort of, you know, structural gimmicks, that's secondary. Just good music. That's the first thing.
Well, the drama that you got with your setting of Daedalus and Icarus is just stunning. There's a lot of Verdi in there that I've heard, the Verdi Requiem. And it's so interesting because it's the only one of the texts that actually does tell a story. And it's such a dramatic story. So that must have been especially a really thrilling section to work on.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, totally. And, you know, the Verdi comparison is very apt. I'm very into opera these days. I've been having a lot of conversations with opera companies about, you know, possibly writing a new opera. And it's captured my imagination a little bit. You know, as a composer who writes often for the voice and large orchestra, I mean, there's no better palette to play with, right? No better format for me. As somebody who likes to sort of tell story through music and orchestration, you know, in a postmodern sort of like referential sort of way, opera is a great format for that, right? It's an art form that I've really sort of loved all my life, but I was always daunted by the prospect of writing something operatic because, you know, as you know, like most new operas kind of get commissioned, they have a few performances and then they die, you know, they go away forever. I'm sort of prepping myself for jumping into that fray in some manner, hopefully, once the world reopens. And to write Daedalus and Icarus, it was a sort of a way for me to test the waters in a way for what a Christopher Tin operatic sound might sound like. And, you know, what's great about that, of course, is, you know, the way that that Greek tragedy is structured with, you know, you have your onstage actors, but you also have a chorus commenting on, you know, the drama. I mean, that was a perfect sort of structure for me to step into, because I love things like call and response, right? I mean, I'm very into things like, you know, African gospel music, for example, which is all about soloist call and response with a choir. So in a way, I found the one corner of the Western canon where I could, you know, bring in this sort of call and response element between a soloist and a chorus that just was the, you know, the perfect encapsulation of what the history of Greek drama actually is, you know, and with the onstage Greek chorus. So that was a blast to write. You're absolutely right. I loved doing that one.
The drama, once Icarus falls and Daedalus is where is he? And then that transition to the fall with the text by Dante is just, it just blows me away every time I hear it. because you've had all this drama and then everything sort of stops and then it picks up again. And so talk a little bit about what you were thinking and how you worked out that transition.
Boy, okay, so as you know, I'm all about transitions between pieces. I just love pieces of music that flow one to the other. You know, attackas, right, between movements. And, you know, in that case of the transition from Daedalus and Icarus to the fall, I was in this position where I knew musically what I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted the last notes that Daedalus sings to be mirrored by sort of these angelic voices that sort of sound like distant, right? And so the musical transition was you know, that's pretty simple. I knew Daedalus is going to sing these notes. I knew these notes were going to be repeated with slight variation, you know, at the start of the next movement. But what I couldn't find for the longest time was what text for them to be singing, you know, in the next movement. I knew that I wanted it to be sort of, I guess, vaguely, you know, Middle Ages-ish. That was it. The breakthrough came when I stumbled upon a quote by Dante. And by the way, like, the way I research my text is I spend a lot of time on the internet, on Wikipedia, and also just Googling things like, you know, 50 best quotes about flight, you know, or stuff like that, right? And you get this horrible, like, I don't know what the sites are, you know, but everyone's a little, you know, shareable meme, you know, and stuff like that, right? And you just kind of scour through those. You go, nope, 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 that's disgusting. That's horrible. That's so boring. That doesn't make sense. That won't make lyrics, you know, that just kind of go through them. But I found the perfect one, and it was by Dante. And it went, "O humankind born to fly, wherefore at a little wind dost thou fall?" And I thought that's the perfect commentary on what just happened at the end of Daedalus and Icarus. Icarus just fell, you know, he just fell into the ocean. And what a great way to follow that up with this amazing quote by Dante. So the movement became about Dante. And then it started me on this sort of like, you know, trip down memory lane, thinking about all my undergraduate literary seminar, you know, like seminars and lectures and things like that, thinking about, you know, the fall of man and Milton and you know, this whole idea of like, you know, the heavens and hell and how Dante sort of mapped all of that out for us, right? He sort of created this vision of heaven, purgatory, and hell. And so I thought, well, okay, if we're going it all in on Dante, let's find other great quotes from the Divine Comedy that we can work into this piece. And so, you know, the three-part structure of the fall kind of mirrors the three-part structure of the Divine Comedy. You know, you fall down to heaven, and then at the bottom, you know, there's sort of like you're at the pits of despair. And then the final section of that piece is, you know, the return of the Sogno di Volare motif, which is sort of our call back to our feet in a way. And that becomes a recurring technique that I use throughout the album. Every time we're in our darkest moments, something calls us back up to get back on our feet, climb back into that cockpit and try again.
It's such a powerful moment when that melody comes back in, and it is true that failure is really the best teacher, and I guess it's what you do with it that makes you stronger or makes humanity stronger in those moments. And it's really subtle, and yet it's also, as you say, just a thread running through. And it sounds almost as if you've kind of weaponized it at the beginning of, oh, the humanity.
I did. You're totally right. You heard that. Yeah, I totally did. It was one of these things where it's like, oh, this will be cool if I just sort of like have a bunch of parallel binary chords, right? And yeah, it sounds a bit like, you know, I mean, oh, the humanity. It basically spans the period leading up to the World War One, and the interwar period, which was, I mean, you know, a period of militaristic nationalism, you know, and that's kind of what it sounds like. It sounds like the dream of flight that's been perverted, right? And that's how I wanted to open up that movement.
And you've got some other sounds in there too. There are sirens. And it what it also kind of reminds me of is how noisy the world had become by that point too.
Yes. I mean, you know, one of the things that sort of captured my imagination about that world. You know, we're talking about like turn of the century, you know. I mean, we're talking about, you know, heavy industrialization in our cities and novelists like Upton Sinclair, right, exposing, you know, just the horrid working conditions of the working class. You know, we're talking about industrial factories and pollution and industrial revolution, cars. We're talking about, cities just sort of like not being able to keep up with the population growth that's been happening there. It was a time of great sort of personal upheaval, I guess. And there have been some really great films made in the first part of the 20th century that sort of celebrated this in a way. Like there's this great film called, I think it's Berlin Symphony of a City.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And it's just this collection of people like, you know, all right, we're going to film this random piece of machinery because it looks kind of, you know, it looks kind of cool, right? It's doing something geometric and it looks kind of like, you know, like ballet in a way, right? And there were all these early sort of cinematic experiments with just capturing motion on screen, setting it to some music, and presenting it as a sort of like a visual dance. And You're right. I mean, I think, you know, that was the sort of the wonderment of that era. It's just like the city has become so kinetic and our lives are so kinetic. And you have offshoots and movements like futurism, for example, in Europe. And that was sort of what they tried to capture at the time. And so you're right to mention that Ode to Humanity brings in some pretty exotic sounds, particularly the air raid siren, because I was very inspired by an American composer living in France during the basically during the World War One post-war period, George Antheil.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Modernist American composer who just moved to France. And he wrote some interesting pieces.
One of them has a propeller in it.
Yeah, exactly. It's got a propeller, right? But the other one, I think it's, is it Amerique's?
Oh, sure.
I can't remember.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it has an air raid siren in it. And I remember this. I remember this as I was writing this piece. I was like, oh, the air raid siren has sort of been introduced to the orchestral repertoire before. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do a piece where the central movement or the central section of it is about, you know, dropping bombs on London, I'm going to use an air raid siren. So we go to Abbey Road. We're recording. I told the, you know, the principal percussionist, Stephen Quigley, I said, hey, you know, I want an air raid siren, you know, and he said, okay, sure. Okay. He's used to me asking for all sorts of crap. And, you know, this is with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, obviously. I mean, my favorite band in the world, I'm going to put it that way. They trotted in three different air raid sirens for me. Like two of them were smaller handheld cranked things. One of them was this large bolted down thing that was like the real deal, you know, like this is what you actually crank if you're getting bombed. And we start rolling the tape, we do a read through, get to the movement, the moment where he starts cranking the air raid siren, right? It's in the score and everything. He cranks it, it quickly obliterates the entire orchestra, and it doesn't stop making noise.
Oh, no.
For like, it just keeps going for about 5 minutes. Because that's what air raid sirens do. There's no off switch, right? So we're sitting here, the entire orchestra's sitting here, we're all waiting for it to go, yeah, just slowly. We're all just kind of looking at our watches. We can't record anymore because this air raid siren just obliterated everything and just ruined the take. And so after that, I said, you know, okay, let's do that after the rest of the orchestra goes on. We'll do it as an overdub, right? So, you know, that was a lot of fun, right? I mean, we had some fun with exotic instruments like the air raid siren or the lion's roar and stuff like that. You know, it was fun.
Yeah, I bet. And it's probably no weirder than any of the things George Martin rounded up for the Beatles either. So speaking
exactly.
of Abbey Road, yeah. You touched briefly on, you know, bringing Robert Oppenheimer into this story too, you know, the dark side of aerospace. And there are some incredible sounds that you put in Become Death, the setting of the Sanskrit. And could you talk a little bit about what those were?
Sure. Okay. So Become Death is a movement about Robert Oppenheimer and, you know, the words he spoke when he saw, you know, the first Trinity test explosion, right? Which was purported to be his translation of the Bhagavad Gita, where he said, and now I am become death, destroyer of worlds. And if you're an opera fan, if you know John Adams, Dr. Atomic, you know, there's a whole baritone aria that's gorgeous in that. Anyway, so me being me, I decided, you know what? I need some Sanskrit in this album. So, you know, instead of like having Robert Oppenheimer's words of, you know, his translation, let's actually go back to the original Sanskrit. And I talked to my friend who's a Sanskrit scholar, and he helped me, you know, find the original Sanskrit. He also helped me find a couple of ragas that were appropriate for, you know, an apocalyptic setting of these words, right? And so that's why the opening sort of medieval sounding chant is in an Indian raga, the Madhya Madhvati raga. You know, I wanted to, you know, make it as authentic as possible, really. But there is that, yes. There's some very sort of modernist sort of orchestration devices with, like, you know, quarter tone bands, pitch dives on woodwinds, things like that. But at the end, when it kind of gets apocalyptic, of course, I bring in my cathedral organ because, you know, why not? And at the very, very end, when you have these really heavy, slamming, low brass pedal notes, there's sort of a whispery choir just sort of babbling over them. That's a very George Crumb technique, right? I mean, that's totally Black Angels right there, George Crumb's, you know, apocalyptic string quartet. And there's a lion's roar, which, if you don't know what that is, it's actually it's a bass drum where you've perforated the head with a needle, and then you rub like violin bow rosin all over a piece of string, and then you crank that piece of string through the hole in the bass drum head, and it makes a sound, right? Totally otherworldly. Kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
you know, and this was kind of this idea of, like, you know, you want to find a sonic signature for the end of the world in a way, right? And it's something that's between, you know, the rapid chattering of voices that, you know, in my mind sort of sound like the victims of Hiroshima, ghostly whispers. And then, you know, using the medieval singers at the very beginning, you know, in my mind, that's sort of like kind of, you know, creating the sensation that, like, you know, the end of our civilization is going to look probably strikingly similar to the beginning of our civilization in a way, you know, like we, through the atomic bomb, we could potentially turn back the clock several millennia on our own development as humans, you know? So that movement in particular is kind of heavy on apocalyptic concepts.
Yes.
So it was a real joy to write that one.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, what's so, I think, really meaningful about this is the way that you've balanced this absolutely terrifying music with quieter, really contemplative movements. Like after the fall, we get introduced to Copernicus and his ideas about astronomy. And there's such a wonderful quietness and thoughtfulness to that movement. And it comes at exactly the right time, because as I've been listening to it, I've been like really engaged and just, you know, stirred up and had my head just exploded with all of these concepts. And then comes along Copernicus. And so your pacing of the album is just really masterful.
Thank you. I mean, there is, you know, okay, in my mind, pacing is one of the core elements of great music. I mean, just knowing what to do and when to do it, that's the real art form, right? And especially if you're creating albums that tell a story and have a through line and are meant to be listened from start to finish, just finding the right moments to do things and finding the right duration to do them is like, it's a big part of the battle, you know? That movement, it's one of these things where it started at 4 minutes, and I think the end result was a 7-minute movement because I added a big organ intro. And, you know, I wanted to evoke sort of, you know, the sense of inner calm that I got from listening to like Brahms's German Requiem, right? Or there's a piece that I sang of his, the Geistliches Lied, Opus 30, that has a gorgeous organ intro and then, you know, just beautiful canonical choral parts. And, you know, that's the sort of sentiment or the sort of lushness I wanted to explore in that movement.
Thank you.
you know, with my own little twist on it. There's kind of a, there's a, it's like a little piano solo in the middle that almost sounds like a, you know, freeform jazz piano solo, right? But the interesting thing about that movement isn't even heard on the recording. One of the things that I thought that I would do is I decided I was going to actually put the constellations in the score themselves using note heads, so that if you, you know, pull out the sheet music and you draw the lines between the notes in this one section, you'll actually draw out all the constellations that have to do with flight. So Pegasus, Draco the dragon, Cygnus the swan, you know, Phoenix, Aquila the eagle, like all of the winged constellations are basically right there on the page if you connect the dots. And that's something that it's sort of like an Easter egg. You know, like I said, I like to shove Easter eggs wherever I can. But in a way, there was a extra element of, you know, craftiness around that, in that I knew that would make for good social media posts, you know?
And has honestly, anyone found them all?
Well, here's the thing. I wasn't going to sit back and wait for anyone to discover them. I just figured I better, like, you know, draw them in the score, right? And that's what I've been doing. I'm working on actually engraving the score for Boozy and Hawks. They're my new publisher. And, you know, one of the things I'm doing is trying to figure out how to put the constellations in the score. But in a couple of weeks' time, actually, there'll be a score video coming out that's sort of an animated video of, you know, the sheet music, basically, in sync to the track itself. And the constellations are sort of animated into that video. And I think it'll be a nice thing to share with the world.
How were you able to make it, to keep it musical, though?
You know, okay, all right. This took me so long to figure out. I mean, for one, you have to rely on sort of a pointillistic texture, you know, like if you want to have, you know, the constellations on the score be accurate to where, you know, what the actual constellations look like, you know, you have to be limited in what you have instruments play in that particular section, right? So, you know, if I have a run of 16th notes, that doesn't actually create a single focal point on the page that I can draw lines from. So you sort of rely on a texture where, you know, the English horn plays one note. And then, you know, like 2.5 beats later, you know, further down on the score, you know, horn one plays a note, you know, and then your piccolo plays a note. And all of these notes are played like forte piano, so that they, you know, they, there's a little bit of color and they sort of hit, but then they fade away quickly and then just kind of add to the lushness of the sound, right? So there was a lot of problem solving to try to make this work. I mean, it's not just about like, oh, let's just find whatever's on the page and, you know, draw some lines between it and make it look good. Like, you really have to sort of figure out where to put things and juggle that against making it sound good, you know, like the recording sound good, right? Because the music is first. You know, if I were to sacrifice the quality of the sound, the quality of the orchestration, just so I could squeeze in this concept that nobody will hear, but people would only see if they went and saw this video, that's the wrong approach. It's always about the music.
Yeah, it's amazing because you can hear these little points and they do, you know, they're reminiscent of stars, but the bigger picture is this wash of sound. So that's just so cool. Wow. It's just Well, I would love to talk with you about the personnel that you lined up for this because, oh my goodness, Danielle Denise is just spectacular.
Uh-huh.
And Pene Pate is incredible. And how soon into the project did you know that you would be able to write music for them?
I think I only knew maybe 3 weeks before I actually recorded them, was at the very tail end of things.
Wow.
Honestly, I knew I had a spot for a tenor and I knew I had a spot for a soprano. I didn't know who they were going to be. And I actually spent a lot of time reaching out to various singers. And some of them expressed interest, but couldn't because of their schedule. Some were too busy. You know, it was a bit of a challenge. But when Danielle heard the mock-up I did of, you know, the Amelia Earhart movement, that's what sold her on it. And so she happened to be in LA singing the lead in Matthew Aucoin's new opera, Eurydice. And so on one of her days off, she popped into the studio and we just did it. And she was fantastic. Just great to work with. She's so good. She's so good. And then Pene Pati, he was someone who was referred to me by Universal. And, you know, they've worked with him. He and his brothers actually form a like an opera trio called Solo Mio. They're, you know, from New Zealand, and you know, they're triple platinum artists in New Zealand and stuff like that. So they're big names. Penne has been singing a lot more opera lately. He had one of these great success stories where he was sort of the kind of the understudy tenor for Gounod's Romeo and Juliet in San Francisco.
Wow.
And then the main tenor bowed out like a few weeks before the production went on. So he basically did the whole run and got huge reviews for it, right? So it's one of these classical breakthrough stories, right? The lead can't do it. You know, the younger guy steps in and wows everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you listen to him, oh my God, what a singer, right?
Oh, yeah.
He's so good. He's so good. They're both amazing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was just lucky to get to work with both of them. And, you know, they know that I have big plans to try to write something operatic, and I plan on working with them more in the future. I love them both.
Yeah, so keep them in your address book and on speed dial, maybe.
Yep.
Well, I would imagine, you know, you plan so carefully with a project like this, but were there any unexpected things that happened?
Well, the pandemic.
Oh, well, yeah. right.
I'm really lucky in that, you know, the very last recording session I did, which was with Danielle Denise, that happened right before the pandemic just shut everything down. I think two weeks later is when, you know, New York suddenly canceled all the concerts, you know, Lincoln Center and Carnegie, like, you know, that's when really the performing arts world shut down, like middle of March. And that really threw the mixing and mastering process into just chaos at that point. That was, I mean, the biggest unplanned thing. And also, you know, we had to basically make some concessions on the world premiere concert. I mean, the world premiere concert was supposed to happen in DC at this huge waterfront venue called the Anthem. And we instead had to postpone it a few months and turn into a digital behind the scenes look of the album with a performance of Courage by Danielle Denise and the U.S. Air Force Band. But truthfully, you know, as you probably know, the pandemic hit choirs extremely hard. Choirs are just not allowed to get together and sing anymore. And all my entire album, except for that one movement, Courage, is choral. So all we could do was put Courage on a screen and, you know, present that to the world. And, you know, once the pandemic lifts, we'll do this for real. But it's been really challenging. But, you know, everyone's going through stuff these days.
Sure. It's just a testament, I guess, again, to your vision and your persistence to make sure that this got released and that it's all over the world now. I mean, it's top of the Billboard chart, which is just incredible. Oh, would you like to say anything at all about the project that's kind of simmering away, or do you want to keep that a secret?
Sure, I can tease a little bit about it. There is going to be a bit of a climate change element to it. That's something that I'm kind of that's a pet issue of mine. Environmentalism, right? I'm very into that. The rough outline of it is it's going to follow the format of a requiem mass for animal extinction. So basically the loss of biodiversity, species going extinct, it's sort of a mass to, you know, celebrate the animals that we've lost in a way, or to honor their memories. That's the rough outlined conceptually about what I want to do. I have some pieces written. I'm sort of focused sort of specifically on birds, actually. And, you know, I think birds are beautiful and, you know, there's a lot metaphorically there that I want to explore. So it's something like that. I haven't worked out all the details yet, but, you know, I'll start making noise about it soon.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I can't wait to hear more about it. So, yeah, is there anything that I didn't get around to asking you about that you'd like people to know?
I mean, I think you've covered it pretty well. I mean, I think that's the thing about what this album meant to me the further we got along into 2020, which is, I swear to God, the worst year on record. You know, it's just a terrible, 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 terrible year, right? I mean, the history of aviation is about the history of failure and resilience. And that's why this album started taking on special meaning for me, you know, as we got further and further into this crisis. Like, yes, we are in dark days now, but there will be a light at the end of the tunnel and we will find a way to reach it. And that's what we do as humans. You know, we rebound, you know, we're resilient. And that's what really sort of helped me, you know, feel good about things in the closing stretch. I mean, I'll tell you, this is no time to release an album. A pandemic, worst time in the world to try to put out a new CD. Can't tour with it, can't do concerts. You know, everyone's so distracted by other news, you know, whether political, world events, health, you know, all these things. There's so much noise to try to cut through in this particular cultural moment. Worst possible time to release a CD, but it still had to be done. And I'm glad that I did it.
Well, and we are too. And I love the optimism that it ends with the we choose to go to the moon, because that's a great place to just stop for now. I mean, obviously the story continues, but that was a moment when there was just so much optimism. And so it's nice to end on a really hopeful note and look forward. And Chris, it's been so much fun to talk with you about this. I really appreciate your time. And it's been so much fun to just kind of dive in and peek under the hood. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I've loved this as well. Thank you so much for, I mean, just a great interview.
Oh, well, you're welcome.
Let's do it again.
Yeah, let's do it again.